The census only happens once every decade. Is Florida ready? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez is heading up the state's efforts to run a smooth census. She wants people to remember that a complete count could mean more benefits for residents.
Everything from school lunch to transportation dollars is really linked to the population here in Florida.
We'll hear more from the Lieutenant Governor. Also, Broward County's issues with sewage pipe breaks is not unique to the area. Florida has a lot of old pipes. Are residents ready to modernize? Finally, the role of Cuban music in local politics is part of life here in Miami. The BBC World Service Arts Hour on tour is in Miami, exploring that story. We'll learn more about their upcoming show. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Every 10 years, the census takes account of the country. The count affects the amount of money that the federal government will allocate to different communities, everything from school lunches to transportation dollars. It'll also shift the number of seats any state will get in the House of Congress. After this year's count, Florida could gain two more seats in the House. Last Friday, we spoke with Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, who is chair of the Florida Legislature's Complete Count Committee. Now, we spoke about the first year of the DeSantis administration and, of course, the upcoming session. But we began the conversation by understanding the importance of a complete and accurate census count.
First and foremost, it's critical because a lot of the federal funding, everything from school lunch to transportation dollars and everything in between, is tied to population counts. And so anything that's a formula from D.C. That brings dollars to our community, to our state, is really linked to the population here in Florida. And as we know, the population in Florida has continued to grow by leaps and bounds, with roughly 1,000 people a day moving to Florida for various reasons. But I think the other important aspect to recognize is that it also is tied to our congressional representation. And so we have congressional seats that more than likely Florida will gain vis-a-vis other states that are losing population, that it's an important aspect as well.
Florida could gain two seats.
Potentially, yes.
You are the chair of Florida's Complete Count Committee. You're in charge of the state's efforts, basically, on making sure we have a successful census. But help me understand, what is this, how the committee works?
Well, we'll be getting started very quickly. The governor announced it recently. We have a broad group of stakeholders. And if you look at that list of individuals that were named to the Complete Count Committee, I think we really tried to encompass all the different aspects. And so one of the priorities we have is to ensure that we're not only getting the accurate count, but we're working in tandem and making sure that those communities that perhaps, like you mentioned, are skeptical, or communities that are hard to count, are understanding that this is nothing to do with immigration policy. This is all about understanding who we have here, who's living in Florida, so that we can get, again, our fair share. I can't stress that enough. But we also want to make sure that we're engaging with the local communities. It's my understanding that counties, all 67 counties, have had some initial work efforts as it relates to census. I know Miami-Dade County, we have Commissioner Bovo, who has led the efforts here locally. He is on our Complete Count Committee at the state level. And so we're hoping to tap in to the expertise we have on the committee, but also work with our local communities, our counties and cities that have already expended resources in some cases, and also effort in trying to bring awareness and trying to bring understanding of what the census is, what it could possibly mean, and what they shouldn't be concerned about.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you talk about the immigration, and so that was one of the controversies, is, you know, the push to get the citizenship question on the census. Supreme Court shot that down. But you've got to get past that fear with immigrant communities and help them understand it. Look, this, there's always a cynicism anyway towards the census, but now you've got to get past that block. Maybe they don't know, they don't understand, they're new to this country. How do you do that?
Well, I think, again, going back to the group of diverse stakeholders we have, we've got everything from, you know, Association of Retired Persons, making sure that the migrant community, the migrant workers, that we have people that are in positions that they have a certain built-in trust with those communities that are your typically hard-to-count communities. And so we want to work with, again, I think the critical part is, from a statewide perspective, it's very difficult for the state to swoop in and convince, whether it's migrant farm workers or other hard-to-count communities, that, you know, we're here, we're trying to get all this information, it's going to be good for you. But that's why I think it's important to tap into local resources and people that have connections. You know, AARP, I think it's important. Senior citizens tend to be fearful of anyone knocking on their door. And so I think these are people that we want to work with and tap into their expertise.
Again, I come back, look at you talked about certain immigrants, especially those who are coming from countries a lot more socialist. There's no trust in government. So how do you break through that? Is there a particular plan on how to help that portion of the community open up and become part of this?
Yeah, and I think that's key. I think the outreach, the education is going to be important. So I know that there has been an incredible amount of funding set aside from the federal government. And I know that, for example, Miami-Dade County has also expended some resources. So we're really hoping to tap into those funding streams. But apart from the funding, I think what you mentioned, that there's no trust in government. But there is trust in the social services, in the nonprofits, in the faith-based community. And so my goal as chair is to lead this initiative and lead this committee in a way that's going to utilize existing resources and really tap into those types of individuals, those groups that have built-in trust, that have linkages to those communities, and be able to, you know, to deliver the message, but work with these folks and do it in a collaborative way so that they see it's not just some government worker coming down, knocking on their door, trying to get them to sign something, but more so people that have existing relationships, organizations that have proven track records, that are going to be able to tap into those communities and to convince them that this is something that's beneficial for everyone.
And something that's a little different this time, or maybe a big difference, is that this year's count is, a lot of it is self-reported. It's done online. So that poses some challenges, because it now puts the impetus on the individual to take the action. It's not somebody knocking on the door or coming to you. You now have to do it yourself. What's the extent of the outreach being done to ensure folks are taking that step?
So that's going to be an important focus for me personally, because as you mentioned, you now have the opportunity to do it online, which for some can be a convenience factor, but for others it could be an impediment. There are communities and there are areas which have difficulty in terms of accessing computers and things of that nature. So I think it's important that and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but that we really do tap into those resources at the local level. You know, the old adage that says all politics is local. In this regard, I really do believe that the outreach efforts, the education, being able to spearhead initiatives whereby in our libraries, in our school district, I know that our school district is allowing for the libraries to be used, our library system, you can go in and use the computers. And so for people, perhaps the elderly, that it's difficult for them, there is an opportunity to do it telephonically as well. And also you can request the long form.
We're talking with Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, recently appointed by Governor DeSantis to chair the statewide committee focused on a complete census count. And we're speaking with Nunez ahead of the legislative session, which begins later this week. Looking at year one of the DeSantis administration, I think a lot of environmental groups were really surprised by his focus on improving water quality, Everglades restoration, relative to the work of his predecessor. Why was the environment such a key priority?
Governor DeSantis spent 3 terms in Congress, and I think he showed at that juncture that he was very committed to issues of the environment, but he campaigned on it, and I don't know why people would be surprised that he actually delivered on his campaign message.
Well, not surprised that he delivered, but surprised that the environment was important for him when his predecessor, Governor Rick Scott, not to say he wasn't putting money and effort into the Everglades, but just the fact that DeSantis even talked about climate change.
Governor DeSantis has shown that he's been really visionary as it relates to Florida. And I think he and I both agree that we're not just borrowing the environment from, you know, from, we're not just getting the environment from our parents, we're borrowing it from our children. And so I think that's something that he is a young, you know, a young father. He has two young children, another one on the way. I think he recognizes the critical nature of where we're at as a state in terms of our environment. So he's focused not only on Everglades restoration, something very important for us down here, but also water quality has been a big, big focus of his. You know, he appointed a chief science officer, he appointed a chief resiliency officer. And so he's a very data-driven governor, and he wants to make informed policy decisions that are based on information that he's getting from his team. And so we've got a, you know, a really renewed, energetic focus from an administrative level on the environment. I think that's something that he wants to be his legacy. And I will tell you, in the very first year, we were able to get historic funding, over $625 million from the legislature. And we're coming back again and asking for that, and perhaps a little bit more. And so we'll see, as these difficult negotiations take place over the course of the next 60 days, how we're able to really make all of that come together.
You're from here. So you understand. You understand the climate risk. You understand the flooding issues that we're facing as seas, oceans rise. We get the sense that DeSantis understands this too. Does he talk to you about that? Does it, because it's not something that they often talk about in Tallahassee.
Right.
Not the way they do down here.
Yeah, no, of course. But I'll tell you, there's been a really renewed focus, not just in our community, as you well stated. That's something that we live each and every day because of, you know, our location. But it's something that's really become an issue of critical importance. When you saw what occurred just, you know, a few short years ago with the blue-green algae and the red tide and how it impacted not just the environmental effects, because that is obvious, but it comes with additional economic challenges. It comes with challenges to our tourism base, which is so critical to our state. It even has health implications. And so there's been, from the governor's perspective, he talks about the environment all the time. And I think that that's something that's refreshing to a lot of Floridians. And people are really taking note of his seriousness as it relates to that particular issue.
So I want to stay on flooding for a moment here, because an interesting action taken by the state, you know, in some of the most flood-prone areas here in South Florida, the state's actually buying back homes in some places, saying these areas, we can't build on it. We can't live in these areas anymore. What more do you believe the state should be doing to address these issues? You look at, for example, the Key Largo community that was flooded for over 100 days. The scientists are saying there are going to be communities throughout South Florida that are going to look like that in the coming decades. What do you think the state needs to be doing now?
The Keys is certainly an area of critical concern, and they have some unique challenges by far, no questions. But what I'll tell you is, in addition to some of those things that you referenced, I think the other issue is, you know, we've got to look at this in a comprehensive manner. You know, we have communities and counties that have neglected their responsibility as it relates to their sewer system. You've seen here in particular, but in other areas of the state, raw sewage being seeped into our ocean, raw sewage being seeped into the bay. And I think that you've seen a number of proposals in the legislature this year in particular, as it relates to increased fines and penalties. I think you have to look at things as well. You know, after Hurricane Irma, and of course, then we had to deal with Hurricane Michael. But I was in the legislature at the time, and we were able to look at the state's response in a holistic way. And one of the issues was in terms of the planning and how certain communities were built upon low-lying areas. And so, really, I think the state has a role to play. But I also think that the locals have a role to play too, in making sure that they're, in terms of planning for the future growth. You know, we want to make sure Florida continues to thrive and grow, but we want to do it responsibly.
So you're saying that the communities, local communities, leaders, local leaders need to take their part.
I firmly agree with that, yes.
Another environmental concern consistently raised is two of them, actually, offshore oil drilling and the issue of hydraulic fracturing or fracking. Where do these issues sit for your administration, for the DeSantis administration?
Governor DeSantis, I think, is wholly committed to making sure that we work with our federal partners. So there's been a lot of discussion. I know, I think there was a nomination that was held up until the position was clarified and things of that nature up in D.C. But he's shown that he's not shy to contact the president when he is either displeased with something. For example, he was really instrumental in getting the feds to increase their Everglades funding. So I think they went from like $67 million to over $200 million. And that was attributed to really his bullish perspective on that. So I think he would not be shy in the least bit to make sure that President Trump knows that he is not in favor of offshore drilling and fracking.
The session's about to start. What would you say is one or two of the most important issues for the governor in this upcoming session?
Certainly continued focus on the environment. We talked a lot about that. So I think he'll continue to push and make sure that we meet our goal. He had set out an auspicious goal of over $2.5 billion over the course of 4 years. So I think he's going to continue to push on that. Obviously, teacher pay is something that he rolled out his proposal a few months ago and is really focused on being able to have that conversation start on teacher pay and where it ends up. We'll see. You know, you never know what you're going to get with the legislative session, but certainly I think that they recognize that that's an important priority for the governor, as well as a continuation of the discussion around school choice. I think Governor DeSantis is very firm on that. And then, of course, as we continue working through the legislative session, he wants to push on business dereg to really make the business climate here, even as good as it is today, he wants to make it even more favorable. And we've seen a lot of growth in the space industry. So we're going to continue to push on that. And I think cyber security and ensuring the security of our upcoming elections is going to be something that he's going to want to focus on.
All right. Well, let's wrap up on the questions of the election. We're coming up on a presidential election year. And look, this is Florida. So we're going to be one of the most important states, and we're going to get a lot of attention. There was a lot of negative attention, though, during 2018. So how do you feel about going into this upcoming election that we're going to get everything secure, everything's going to be in place, we can run a smooth election?
Absolutely. I was appointed chair of the state cybersecurity task force as well. And so we just started meeting recently, and we've been working very closely with folks, both from the private sector, but also internally at the state. We've got our Florida Department of Law Enforcement engaged. We've got our Secretary of State, as you know, that oversees the supervisors of elections, and she's been doing a very thorough review of each and every county. Look, you and I both know the history with Florida and elections. I know Governor DeSantis and I do not want to be on the front page of every major newspaper in the country saying Florida did it again. And so we've put in some dollars to ensure that we have all the necessary built-in provisions in place to secure our elections. But in addition to, it's not just about the elections. Of course, that's what's going to get the headline. But we want to make sure the state holds a significant amount of citizens' data. And so we feel it is our responsibility to do everything we can to protect that data, whether it's driver's license information or medical data. So we are taking that very seriously. We will work with the legislature and encourage them to spend as much as they need to make sure that our cyber is as secure as possible.
As a voter, I'm asking you, Lieutenant Governor, is the election secure? Should I be confident before November?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You should be confident. I know that the Secretary of State has done a number of things in her review. I think that'll all be coming out. You know, obviously, some of it is secure and confidential information. But we want to make sure that every citizen knows that their vote will be secure. We're taking action now early on to make sure that there is no potential breaches. In addition to not just breaches and potentially changing up your data, but, you know, false information that gets placed on the web. And so we're thinking through it from every angle, and we're going to make sure that we're ready.
Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Always great talking to you.
Again, that was Florida Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, chair of the Florida Complete Count Committee. And we spoke about the upcoming census and the upcoming legislative session, which, by the way, begins tomorrow. And we're going to bring you our sister station WFSU's live anchored coverage of the governor's State of the State address, including the Democratic response. All of that starting tomorrow at 11 a.m. Well, still to come, Fort Lauderdale is dealing with constant sewage breaks. Florida is facing a crisis, as our pipes are getting old and they need to be replaced. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Fort Lauderdale residents just cannot catch a break with their sewage problems. Their 50-year-old sewage system has broken down six times since December. Now, those breaks have spewed nearly 127 million gallons of sewage and wastewater into the streets. Fort Lauderdale City officials have been rushing to address the crisis. Fort Lauderdale City Manager Chris Lagerblum joins us now via Skype. Mr. Lagerblum, thank you so much for the time.
Absolutely. Good afternoon.
Within the last month, six sewage spills in Fort Lauderdale. Tell me what's different about these breaks, but also what's the common thread with all of them?
So the difference is where they're located in the city. Some are in the south part of the city, others in the north. The common thread is that they're all pipes of about the same vintage, same material, and same age.
All right. What tends to break the pipes? What's causing the problem mostly?
So in these pipes, what we're seeing is corrosion and wear, wear over time. And we're seeing that the pipes have real thin walls at the bottom of the pipe, which would make sense over time that they've just been consistently wet and consistently under pressure with sand and other grit in the system. And they're failing at the bottom of the pipe.
How old is that system?
So our system dates back many, many decades. This pipe that we're talking about now dates back to the early 70s when it was originally installed.
How would you describe the sewage system, the pipe and sewage system in Broward County right now? What's sitting underneath us?
So I'm familiar more with what's in Fort Lauderdale than I am in the entire
okay.
of Broward County. But what I can tell you is that we've got a system that has an assortment of materials, an assortment of ages, an assortment of maintenance work that needs to be done. And we now have identified all of the pipe condition in Fort Lauderdale, and we have a plan to move forward to do the replacements as they need to be done so that we're not continually chasing these types of breaks just from pipes that are at their end of life.
How long has the city been aware of the fact that the system, I mean, well, you know, the system is old, but how long has the city been aware of the fact that, you know, maybe it's old to the point where it's time to replace because you're going to have a lot of breaks?
Right. And so these aren't the first sewer pipe breaks that the city of Fort Lauderdale has had. We've watched over the past several years and we're able to predict that these pipes need to be replaced. And we're doing something a little bit differently now than we've ever done before. And that's rather than just replace a piece of pipe where the whole has emerged is to take whole sections of pipe. And so there's no reason to believe that the pipe is in any different condition 40 feet further down or 60 feet further down. And so rather than patch it and just wonder how long it's going to be until we come back and deal with another break, we're making wholesale replacements of pipes that are showing their age.
And thank you for clarifying that. This isn't unique. This has been happening for some time. And actually, looking at a recent study that came from the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, since 2009, not just Fort Lauderdale, the state of Florida, there have been 23,000 cases of pipes breaking. The state of Florida has old pipes, old systems. So you're talking about, and it's not just about fixing the problems as they come up. Are you basically saying you got to replace the whole system? It's time for a whole remodel?
Well, it's time for the replacement of those pipes that have consistently shown themselves to be at risk of failure. We've gone in and done little segments and said, okay, the hole's gone. Let's put it back under pressure. And whether it's been 6 days, 6 weeks, 6 months, or 6 years, the pipes aren't getting any newer. And so we find ourselves just going back and replacing different sections of the same pipe. We have to get out of the business of doing that. And that's what we've embarked upon at this point.
And why are sewage pipes particularly problematic for coastal cities like Fort Lauderdale? What does that adds an extra challenge?
It does. It adds a layer of complexity because they're always in a corrosive environment. I mean, our groundwater table is close to the surface. We deal with saltwater intrusion, and these pipes being iron, they're in that constant corrosive environment, and that adds one additional set of complexities to how these pipes age.
That's the other thing too. I was just thinking, like, is there an expiration date on the pipes because they're made of iron? Don't we know how long they're going to last?
Well, there's a lot that goes into pipe condition and pipe when it might potentially fail, other than age. And that's the study that we've recently done. There's 16 or 17 different criteria that we evaluate the pipes on and give us a priority of how they should be replaced and in what order they should be replaced. But yes, the iron, obviously, in the saltwater environment, that's not a perfect mix.
Have you seen any other coastal cities anywhere in the world who they've replaced their pipes, or they have a different type of material they're using for their pipes that help protect them?
Well, the pipes have changed over the years, and the pipes that were installed in 1973 are a very different pipe than what's installed today. Even the iron pipes of today have additional layers of coating on them that help them withstand the environment. But we'll, as we replace these pipes and as we install this new force main from the north to the south in the city, new materials will be used, and there will be some iron pipe in it, but it's this generation iron pipe, as well as a higher density pipe that is not iron, that will be the large lion's share of the pipe that we put in the ground today.
So at a city meeting last week, the city mayor, Dean Trentalis, blamed the previous administration for the problems with the sewage pipes. Here's what he said.
The prior administration raided utility funds and spent the money to balance the budget for the city's general operation. This shell game took $20 million a year that should have been earmarked for utility maintenance and upgrades. In all, they drained $120 million in reserves.
Why is the mayor blaming them?
So the mayor in that statement is talking about a return that was taken out of the utility, the water and sewer utility, and transferred to the general fund. It was a practice that has been done, and it was done over a period of time. It's a practice this commission does not want to do, and have given me the direction over a four-year period to reduce that transfer. I said last week, and I commit to it again, that we can do it in three instead of four, and we will no longer be relying upon any transfer into the general fund.
I'm speaking with Fort Lauderdale City Manager Chris Lagerblum. He is with us discussing the sewage pipe breaks that have spewed, again, more than 127 million gallons of sewage and wastewater into the streets over the past month. The city, like a lot of parts of Florida, they just have old pipes, as we're learning. There have been a number of meetings to address the infrastructure problems and what the next step is. And, of course, folks living in Fort Lauderdale have spoken up about their thoughts on this. And so, Mr. Lagerblum, you've heard them. The residents have said, some of them are saying, that the biggest problem right now is the development downtown. It's the problem. They say it's adding pressure to these pipes. Do residents have a case here?
So I've heard those discussions too. We believe that our sewer system has capacity and it has volume in it to accommodate the growth that has occurred in the downtown. We do a very thorough evaluation anytime we get an application in for a development project to say whether or not our systems can handle it. And if they can handle it, then that's great. And if they can't, then we don't allow the development to happen until certain upgrades are made to the system so that the volume can be handled. So yes, whereas development will create more volume, I don't know that that translates into pressure into the system. And we certainly do have capacity at our plant.
And as you know, some of the residents are calling for a moratorium on new development. Is that even feasible?
That would be something that the commission would have to establish from a policy perspective. Moratoriums hold the status quo until something changes. I've heard our commission generally speak about it, but not be in favor at this point of a complete stoppage in development. But certainly if they choose to have that policy discussion, then that's something that we'd have with them.
Our news partners, the Miami Herald, reported that a lot of the sewage spill was not human waste, but actually groundwater that was seeping in. Sea level rise is soaking the metal pipes. You touched on this, the salt water causing some of that corrosion. And that, of course, leading to some of these breaks, and that's getting out into the streets. What conversation is the city having with different groups about these environmental concerns, about the issue of sea level rise and how that's playing a role?
Yeah, so, that's one of the big things that we're doing right now is a program to keep groundwater and stormwater out of our sewer system. What gets transported to the plant, once it gets there, the plant doesn't know any difference, and it just treats what shows up. So we've done an aggressive relining program of our pipes in our six largest sewer basins. What that means is that the pipes, any opportunity for water or groundwater or stormwater to enter into the system is removed. We've started to see noticeable reductions in the amount of flow into the plant itself. And so, you know, we've got to take our system from that perspective too, and try to keep the stormwater and the groundwater out.
Last year, the commission approved $200 million to begin to address this problem. But how much is that going to replace? What can $200 million do?
Well, it does a couple of things. It starts by adding sufficient funds so that we can really get a good handle on study of the system. We're complete with the phase one evaluation of the pipes themselves, moving into a phase two, which will cause us to do some preventative digging and pipe inspection, just so we can look at the pipe rather than try to guess what it looks like. And then we've got certain projects that we're in the middle of completing now. And, you know, it gets us about 5 years down the road. And then I think we have multiple 5 year segments before we have the program complete.
And what's the difference between that $200 million and last week the city commission voted to spend $65 million to replace one of the main sewer lines? I think is correct, right?
That's right. Yeah. So a portion of the $200 million is the dollars that were appropriated to this new force main project.
Okay. You know what? This you may have touched on this just a second ago, because I was thinking about, you know, one of the neighborhoods affected was Rio Vista. And the city has said that fixes are expected to be done within 90 days. But how is Fort Lauderdale prioritizing, you know, which pipes to address first, considering, as you said, it's probably a big chunk of the system that has to be replaced?
Sure. Sure. We've identified which pipes we believe are most at risk, and then which ones are at a little bit higher risk, and then which ones, frankly, are relatively new. And so we've got some critical crossings in the city where we know we go under a water body. We're looking at those as priorities, and we generally have a plan of which one should come first based upon that 16 or 17 set of criteria I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and as you said, so right now the city's assessing the entire sewer force main system. What does that assessment entail? How long will that take?
So our phase one of that is done, which was part of the work that we did with Hazen and Sawyer, a large engineering firm, as a part of our consent order compliance. That work is done. We're now doing some preventative preliminary digging to go take a look at the pipe and see what kind of condition it's in, just visually, as opposed to trying to put a mathematical formula to it. And the work is underway. So the work will continue, and we just need to be laser focused on the fact that this is important, and that we prioritize it as such.
And, you know, look, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people are concerned because of this wastewater, some of it again sewage, that is getting out in the streets. That can cause a health risk to some people. But what are you hearing from people? What do you tell them?
So we did everything we could do to keep it as contained as possible, and launch every vacuum truck we can launch and every environmental cleanup crew we can launch at the breaks when they occur. We tell people to stay away from the raw sewage, that if they should come into contact with it, we advise folks to have a bleach solution nearby to sanitize. And we obviously had environmental experts at all of the breaks that we would dispatch to different homes to meet, carry out their sanitation activities as well.
One other thing I wanted to ask you too is this: how much of a role does, you know, our activity as human beings play into what's happening with the pipes? I mean, because I know going back, we're always told certain things you shouldn't be putting in the drains or flushing down the toilet. All right, I think that, do I still have him there?
Sounds like, I think I may have lost you, but I am here.
Yeah, there you are. Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Lagerblum, if you could answer that question for me.
You started to ask the question about what people put in the sewer system, and I didn't hear the balance of it.
No.
I think that question would probably go.
Yeah, basically, we've always been told to be careful what we put down the drains. How much of this is on us?
You know, you'd be amazed when we take a sewer pipe out, some of the things that people that somehow get into our system. Yes, I mean, we play just as much a role as anybody in the health of a sewer system over a period of time, and certainly would encourage people to keep things out of the sewer system that don't have to be there, and that definitely helps keep the condition healthy.
We've been talking with Fort Lauderdale City Manager Chris Lagerblum. Again, you can find more of our reporting on the sewage problems plaguing the city. Just go to WLRN.org. He was joining us via Skype. Mr. Lagerblum, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
All right, still to come, Miami has a deep history of Cuban music and culture. We're going to dive into some of that history with the BBC. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Every day, millions of listeners from around the globe tune into the BBC World Service. And one of the monthly programs, the Arts Hour on Tour, takes listeners to different cities around the world and introduces them to musicians and artists and cultural changemakers in that region. In the past couple of months, host Nikki Beatty has traveled from Brazil to Bosnia, and now they've brought the show to Miami. Mm-hmm. Joining me now in studio is Nikki Beatty. Nikki, welcome.
Thank you so much and good afternoon. What a lovely studio you have here.
Well, thank you very much. Welcome to Miami, I should say.
Thank you. I have to tell you that I think on some cellular level, I am meant to be in the tropics. And I'm also meant to live somewhere near one of your beach strips and run every morning and feel that heat and the salty spray the sea.
Well, how about this? Tell me right now, what's the weather like back at home?
It's gray and drizzly and rather cold.
There you go. This is winter in South Florida.
I know.
So this is just life for us. The Arts Hour has traveled, as I said, to so many different parts of the world. What interested you guys in Miami? Why us?
So you have the most extraordinary convergence of many cultures in this city, especially Latin cultures. Now, I have a question for you, actually. Do you say Latino or do you say Latinx?
Oh, it's, you know what? I've spent most of my life saying Latino.
Right.
But I understand Latinx is now becoming part of the vernacular.
But tonight, when I record the show, do you think it would be okay if I avoided the fight between those two descriptions and just said Latin cultures?
I think you could be all right with
Thank
that.
Thank you. I'm going to say you said so. Okay. but the other thing that brings us here, obviously, is that you have a huge Cuban population here. And the idea of cultural exchange between Cuba and the Cuban diaspora in Miami is really fascinating, which is why a couple of the guests on the stage tonight use that axis with their work.
See, it's so fascinating. I mean, look, there's you could do hours and hours and hours on that alone. So mm-hmm. How did you decide on what you're going to focus on for this particular program?
Well, very often we will want to go somewhere where there's some sort of change going on. So, for example, when Obama was president, he relaxed some of those rules for culture exchange. Bear in mind, we are talking about the arts. We are not a political show, although, of course, through the prism of the arts, you often get your politics and current affairs and social issues raised. But under your current president, President Trump, some of those rules have been reversed. And we found that grist interesting. So, you know, just like in an oyster shell, that little bit of grit can become a pearl. That idea then develops. And when we look at the guests that we're choosing, we think, okay, they've got a lot to say on that. That looks like a good thread for the show.
You know, as you said, I mean, the program is not about politics, but you have these discussions with you bring people together to sit and talk, and you may start somewhere, but you can go anywhere. The conversations can go a lot of places.
They can, but you know as well as I do that as a host, you have to have your sort of your bones to build the flesh on, don't you? And you have to bring it back to that skeleton.
I like that. That's a good way to put it. Exactly. for people who don't know, though, just tell them how you organize the show, because you have so many different voices.
Yes. So we always have two music acts, unless for some reason we've got one of the biggest stars in that country, we may just have them performing. But our ideal is to have two music acts. One of them will perform twice. So in this case, it's Sima Funk. He'll be performing at the top of the show and at the end of the show. And then we have the incredible Leslie Kartaya. We also try and have comedy wherever we go, because often a comedian can say things that other people can't and use humour to convey a certain message. Sometimes humour doesn't translate, or the language isn't good enough in English. So we have on occasions taken a spoken word artist to deliver a similar slot. And then we have our panel discussion, and we have people from the world of cinema, theatre, literature, any sort of music, all the arts, really. We've had architects, photographers.
Well, you know what? I mean, just to give a taste, this is your show focuses again on this intersection of arts and politics. The recent one you had, you were in Brazil in the fall, and there was the devastating wildfires in the Amazon rainforest, which now we're witnessing that in Australia. You spoke with the creator of
Aruanas,
yes, which is a digital web series in Brazil, and that follows four activist women protesting against a mining company. This is the director speaking. I believe it's Esteia Rainer. Let's hear it.
Well, Aruanas is completely inspired on three events, and we understood that due to this climate emergency that we are living on right now, we had to do something that talked to more people. And we know that fiction does that job. You can imagine easily life in the White House because of House of Cards or the West Wing.
Yeah.
But does anyone know about the life of an activist? So with that in mind, we created Aruanas.
Esteia Rainer, tell me more a little bit about her. Tell me a little bit more about what you were trying to get in that conversation.
Well, interestingly, that was a show where we had four guests from the world of screen. It wasn't intentional. It's the way it worked out. So you know who Fernando Meirelles is, the film director who made City of God. His son has also started to make a series. He's done it for HBO Latin. So we had him on stage. Then we had a filmmaker who'd made documentaries about a right-wing interesting character, let's say. So the way that cinema has a hold, or television has a hold on that country, and the way you can disseminate messages through the power of television, somebody once said it was the opium of the masses. And certainly, I think you can tell stories through screen much more easily than to encourage people to read a book, especially in 2020. So Esteia was doing two things for us. She was talking about the television industry. She was also talking about women, because her show was utterly femicentric, four women telling their own stories. And she was then able to talk about issues about mining, about bribing, about governments, about the ecological situation. You mentioned the fires. So we were able to get opinions through a script for the screen.
You know, one of the guests that you're going to have for this show, our listeners will recognize the music, Leslie Kartaya.
Yes.
And that's, of course, you know, the lead singer for the band Bala, which makes the theme music for our show. Why did you want to include that Afro-Cuban music and you know, the Nexus Cuban and funk as part of the program? What was interesting to you?
Well, first of all, the sound,
yes,
obviously.
That's true.
It's so infectious and so fantastic. Also, it's another example of how all those cultures come together and create something fresh and new, but are looking back to their roots in every sense. And it's, you know, we're making radio. So you want something that makes people lean in or makes them tap their feet and move around. It's just an incredible sound. Also, she's been in Miami, I think, for nearly 20 years now. And so having that perspective, somebody who grew up in Cuba, who came here 20 years ago, she's able to talk about the homeland and the new home. It's a fascinating nexus.
I'm talking with Nikki Beatty, host of the BBC World Service Arts Hour on Tour. I want to get into your story. This is fascinating.
Okay, can I just say one thing?
Say it.
I hate it when people do this to me when I'm on that side of the desk. You actually carry the Arts Hour on this station.
That's
at
true.
4 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. I know you won't all get up at that time to listen to it.
Some people do. You'd be surprised. your career started in India?
Yeah.
Right?
It did.
As an actress?
I'm actually half Indian. So for the benefit of those of you who can't see me, I'm blonde and fair-skinned with blue eyes. So it's people don't believe I could be half Indian, but I am.
On what side of your family?
Father.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was born Nikhila Kanta Mulgaonkar. And yes, I spent a lot of time in India growing up, but essentially I was born and raised in the UK. Went on family trips to India as a child and then moved to India when I was 20 and immediately started acting in stage productions and on screen. And I didn't speak a word of Hindi other than really bad words because my father thought it was hilarious to have this little girl with blue eyes and fair skin using cuss words that not even an adult should be using.
So how does a young woman with fair skin and that blonde hair, what roles is she playing?
Okay, let me
ask you that.
Okay, so I do not want to in any way bring down Bollywood, but in Bollywood, it's rather formulaic. So there are about five roles a white woman can play. One is a CIA agent, no matter how you fit into the plot. So the foreign hand in some way, seriously. The other one is your foreign returned Indian. So he studied in the States, for example, at university, Wharton Business School or something, coming back to run the family business. And you're the American girlfriend that he's met out there who comes in to mess up mummy's idea of arranged marriage for her precious son. You can be a drug addict, you know, some sort of really loose character, a gangster's mole, or a rape victim, no matter how you fit into the plot. That's how reductive it's been in the past. One more thing. You can be a British Raj Memsahib in flouncy dresses from the 17th century.
There you go. I'm just picturing this. How do you go from that to now being a news presenter, being a host?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't consider myself a news presenter. I consider myself to be an arts broadcaster, which is not...
Still different than playing a CIA agent.
It is. And I'll tell you what's interesting, apart from playing all those roles. I also did all kinds of roles on TV in Hindi, which I didn't even speak at the time. But I think the first option that I had to be a presenter or a host, as you would call it, was when a channel from the UK wanted somebody who straddled both worlds to do a talk show. So I fitted that, you know, that little gap that they needed. And from the moment I started to use my own brain and my own words, as opposed to a director's and a script writer's, that was my métier. I found my métier.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about is you have this opportunity to travel the world and tell stories from different cities to listeners all over the world. And I wondered, you know, because, I mean, for me, I'm just talking about life here in South Florida. So it's about what's happening here. But what have you learned from that experience as to how different people in the world view everybody else?
Well, I think what's really interesting to me is that you couldn't do this job properly if you weren't an internationalist, if you weren't curious, if you weren't open. So we don't come to Miami pretending that we know everything or even a lot about the Cuban culture here, which is what we're focusing on tonight's show. We come asking questions, saying, show us this, explain that, reveal your passions and your fears for this. And in doing that, I become the conduit and the BBC World Service becomes the conduit to tell those stories that don't get told. So it is such a privilege to do this. It not only expands my mind, but also the minds of all the listeners who otherwise wouldn't necessarily ask questions about a particular culture or people. So I think it's a marvelous thing.
I think it's one of the fascinating things about you know, the programming that over the years that I've heard from the BBC is the fact that you get to hear voices from other parts of the world you don't always get to. So at least that way you get an inside view of how people are thinking.
Exactly, and it stops us being parochial, you know, and just only thinking we exist in our own bubble. I like the word glocal. I like the idea that you can be a global person and a local person. So you can be passionate, for example, about Miami and South Florida like you are, but you can also have your mind open and be receptive to all kinds of other cultures.
Nikki Beatty, host of BBC World Service Arts Hour on tour. Find more details about the event at the Quebec Center. Again, it'll be online at WLRN.org. Nikki, such a pleasure. Enjoy your time in Miami.
Thank you so very much.
Enjoy the beach. The weather's perfect. That's Sundial for this Monday, January 13th. Coming up on Sundial tomorrow, the House is set to consider a resolution this week that will move the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. A new NBC Telemundo poll examines voters' opinions on impeachment and voting issues ahead of this presidential election. We're going to speak with reporter Noah Pransky about South Florida views on impeachment. Plus, this month, don't forget, we're reading Mothers of Sparta for the Sundial Book Club. The memoir from Fort Lauderdale author Dawn Davies explores her life as a writer and parent here in South Florida and, of course, raising special needs child. You can always join the book club. Find us on Facebook and just look us up, Sundial Book Club, and join. It is free. We'd love to have you. And we want to hear your thoughts on the book if you're reading it this month. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.